This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Hello, and welcome back to the Monday Morning Break. My name is Kandu Kutik. And my guest today is an educator from a British Curriculum International School in Dubai. We'll be speaking about what EAL, English as an Additional Language, actually is.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hello again, and welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us in this episode, which is the first in my series with educators at international schools worldwide. My guest today is Gemma Donovan, who is head of EAL at a British Curriculum International School in Dubai. Gemma will be explaining what EAL, English as an Additional Language, is as a teaching subject, and how this compares to the teaching of EFL, English as a Foreign Language. Let's see if my guest is here. Yes, Gemma, I can see you. You are here. Please click on the call in button so that we can... There we go. So that we can bring you into the conversation. Hello, Gemma.
Hi, Conduct. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. You sound excellent. Welcome, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's really good to have you here, kicking off our series with educators from international schools. But first of all, Gemma, how are you? How has your Monday been?
It's been good so far, thank you. We've been recovering from the floods here in Dubai. We had a terrible storm on Tuesday of last week, but yes, the city's back to normal and we're all doing well. So, good day so far.
Okay, well, glad to hear that. That was horrific. I read somewhere that Dubai got 256 millimeters of rain in one day. Dubai would normally receive in a year, in 75 years or something like that.
Yes, I think it was the worst storm that had hit Dubai and hit the UAE in 75 years. So yes, it was unprecedented, but the response has been good. And we were all online last week, remnants of COVID times. It did make us think a little bit of that. But yeah, everyone mobilized really well and we're all back in school today and offering distance learning as well. So have to say the response has been good and, the city's getting back to normal as best as it can.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I'm glad everything's almost back to normal. So Gemma, tell us briefly how you ended up as an educator in an international school, how you moved from EFL to EAL.
Well, I've been in the field of EFL for 20 years now. I was a language student quite a long time ago at Manchester University, and I moved to, I did Italian and Spanish, moved across to Naples once I'd finished university, and stayed in Italy for 15 years, where I was an EFL teacher. So I worked at the British Council, I worked at lots of different state schools and university level courses within Italy. Online learning and the whatnot. And then from there, I moved to Dubai with my family 6 years ago now. Originally came over working in the government sector, teaching Emirati students and working within that sector. And it's been a few years now, I've been working in the British Curriculum School in the private sector. in particular in the field of EAL. So it's an interesting transition. And yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. It's good.
Okay. That's quite the journey you had. I mean, we spoke last week, and how you got into EFL is similar, you know, to how many of us in the ELT sector teaching outside of state schools get into the teaching of English. But then the shift then into EAL, did you have to have, or did you have any specific qualifications that, you know, would make you qualified, for lack of a better word?
With, you know, with an experience as diverse as I had within EFL, the CELTA, CELT-YL, and various other PD, you know, certificates that I'd gathered along the way. And then I obviously have my master's in TESOL, which has been a tremendous help in the, you know, just having a broad understanding of the whole field of EFL itself. EAL, I have to say, has renewed my enthusiasm in the, you know, as a practitioner, I suppose, because it is a different branch to ELT. It's more immediate. You don't have the luxury of time on your hand like you would as an EFL teacher. If I take my experience at the British Council, for example, in Italy, you know, students would join, they would join a 60-hour course or a 90-hour course, they'd be a certain level, and you would be assured that at the end of those hours, that student would then progress to the next level. Obviously, it's all much more immediate within the EAL sector. The students can arrive at a school in September with little to no English, and are faced with being put in the mainstream classroom more or less straight away. And it's our job as an EAL team to assist them in their journey. So we're trying, I would say it's different from EFL in that sense, as you are giving students strategies and working very closely with the mainstream classroom teachers to provide those strategies for the children to access the curriculum very quickly in a language that's not their own. So yes, it's interesting, but very rewarding at the same time.
Right. So you've touched on the learners themselves in this context of, you know, EAL versus EFL. But for those of us who are confused or who'd like, you know, a deeper understanding of terminology, what exactly, I mean, if you're studying English as a foreign language, one could argue, well, surely that's an additional language to you. So why the difference in the terminology? What distinguishes in terms of the terminology EAL from EFL? Why, you know, why can't we just call everything EFL?
Well, that's a very good question. I, from my understanding and from just being on the ground, EAL seems to be the terminology that's used within the school sector. English is an additional language. There's also the terminology multilingual learners, MLLs. I think it can cause some confusion even within the school sector itself. Students can be EAL even if their home language is any other language other than English. So we can have students who are very competent in English but are on the EAL register within the school system. So we differentiate between EAL, and then to add another terminology, another acronym into the mix, we have ELL students, who are our English language learners. So those are the students who are followed closely by our department, who we support in their language journey. In an international setting, as what I'm in at the moment, the majority of our students would be classified as EAL, i.e. those who have English as an additional language, those who have English in addition to the home language that they speak with their families and at home. So I would say that's the main difference. EFL I see as being the main umbrella term for
Okay. So I see the distinction, and the way you've described it, I think the main distinction is in what they're using English for. And I think additional here is a big clue. Like you say, it's a language that's additional to the one that they would use predominantly, right? And if they're in a school setting, then the language that they would use in that setting is English, whereas at home, they would use any of their other ethnic languages. Whereas with EFL, English as a foreign language, you'd go into, you know, let's say in my setting, I teach EFL. It's at university. They probably use English in, you know, a small number of courses. In other courses, German is the medium of instruction. So it's not necessarily an additional language to them.
I think you're right. And I think we can get confused with a lot of the terminology because there's a lot out there that fundamentally does cover the same type of teaching. We're all fundamentally teaching English through the medium of English. Well, in this case, through the medium of English. In my last setting, the department, for example, was called EMI, English as Medium of Instruction. So again, mm-hmm. that was very similar to the EAL that we're doing now. And I agree with you. It's when the students are learning subjects through a language that is not their home language. So it's not just learning it as a foreign language, just, you know, their whole instruction is in that additional language. I agree. That would be right. The main distinction.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked about that, about EAL, and you mentioned also ELL. Tell us about your school. You mentioned that, you know, EAL is the terminology used in the school sector. I've not heard it in English medium schools. I've heard it predominantly in international schools. So tell us about your school, the context of your school, and so on.
Well, we're like, you know, there are many, there's many international schools within Dubai in our case. So we have, we're a British curriculum school. The past few years had a big influx of students who arrive not speaking English. So therefore mm-hmm. there's been a demand for a department to grow. The EAL department has grown based on demand. And I think this is the changing demographic across the Emirates, I would say. There's an influx of newcomers to the Emirates and those who, as I say, arrive with little to no English. So international schools, although British curriculum, American curriculum, now have to really cater for those who those students who are enrolling, who need to access the curriculum from the early stages, but are arriving not necessarily with the linguistic capacity to be able to do that straight away. So yes, that's the current situation where we are. If you think we have 80% of our students, more or less, are EAL and predominantly Arabic speakers. Now that's not to say that they're all in the early stages of their learning, of their English learning journey, they're very competent English language speakers. But then there's obviously been this growing need for a specific department that deals with the needs of our ELL students, enabling them to integrate fully into the school community and access the curriculum to the best that they're to the best of their ability.
Right. Why would families send their children to international schools if their children have little to no English? Could they not, for instance, go to the local schools?
Well, I think within our setting, there aren't schools that cater to all of the diverse languages that that obviously present themselves within this context. On our ELL register alone, we have Persian speakers, many Russian speakers. Mm-hmm. There aren't those structures here at the moment that cater for those, just for those students who speak that language, or if there are, there are very few. So I think right. also the reputation of a British curriculum school and so on and so forth also speaks for itself. I think people want a solid curriculum. They want a school that's established. In our school setting in particular, it's a very family oriented school, not too big. It's a community school. So I think parents are looking for somewhere where, when they arrive in the country, their children will feel safe, not too overwhelmed, and their needs will be catered for. And I think we certainly offer that at the moment where we are.
Okay. What age groups does the school you work in cover?
Okay, we are a through school, so we're from FS, so students are arriving foundation stage, right through to year 12. So we cater for the full age group, foundation, mm-hmm. primary, secondary. And, you know, obviously there are different needs amongst those students. One would argue that when they arrive at a very early age, the nature of early years teaching is so communicative and fun and play-based that students of that age, pupils of that age, learn very, very quickly through the environment in which they're in. Obviously, as you move up the school, it becomes more challenging when a student's arriving in year five, year six, the final year of primary, with little to no English, and the expectations of the curriculum are rather demanding, more so even moving into secondary. That's when it becomes a little bit more challenging, and there really does have to be a lot of collaboration, I believe, between classroom teachers and the EAL specialists, the EAL team, inclusion team also as a whole, to work together to find those strategies that are going to allow those students to access the curriculum fully.
Right. And those who go on then to year 12 at the end, do they then sit for the British school leaving exams like the A-levels or GCSEs?
Yes, the aim is that the students are able to access the exams as the other students do as well. So we have students arriving in year 9, 10, 11, and you know, they're accessing the exams that the other students have to access as well. Of course, it takes more support, patience, and something we haven't touched on, but I am a big believer in, is that when these students do arrive, part of the learning journey is not just getting them up to scratch, so to speak, with their language ability and their ability to access the curriculum, but also the social emotional side of learning. I'm a strong believer that if these students are made to feel welcome, made to feel part of the community, you know, research dictates your effective filter lowers, the students become more open to learning, and that really, really facilitates their learning journey. So it's a real holistic approach that schools have to take, I think, to these students' learning journey.
Before we continue, thank you for that so far, Gemma. Before we continue, let's listen to a message from our sponsors and the news of the week.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
According to reports on the BBC News website, the EU wants to agree a deal with the UK that would make it easier for people aged between 18 and 30 to study abroad in the wake of Brexit. The European Commission says it would be a limited arrangement, not the restoration of freedom of movement. The UK already has schemes with some non-EU countries, and these allow people to come to the UK for up to 2 years. Downing Street says it's open to extending this to individual EU members rather than throughout the EU, but prefers country-by-country deals. The proposed EU scheme has time limits, and UK participants would only be able to stay in the EU country that accepted them. The report goes on to say that it would reduce controls on young people moving between the UK and EU. The European Commission says it is stepping in after the UK approached several EU countries to discuss deals. The Commission says it risked differential treatment of EU citizens and there should be a bloc-wide deal for equality. The UK turned down an offer to continue participating in the EU's Erasmus student exchange after Brexit, but did replace it with the Turing scheme, which provides exchanges worldwide. The BBC South East team have covered concerns expressed by some students that they may run out of ADHD medication during the upcoming exam period. Some students have reported rationing their medication in order to stretch it out following reports of shortages due to an increase in demand and manufacturing issues. ADHD medications are often controlled drugs, which means prescriptions are limited to a month's supply, although some pharmacies also struggle to fill even this. The NHS advises against any changes of dosage without medical advice, but families continue to feel anxious about the possibility of young people struggling through the exam season. The Guardian reports on findings from communications regulator Ofcom, which suggests that a quarter of 3- and 4-year-olds in the UK now own a smartphone. Half of children under 13 are on social media. Online activity by infant school-aged children is rising. These findings could boost the argument of those urging the government to clamp down on social media and phone use by young children. A consultation will likely be launched in coming weeks, according to sources in government. This could include a proposal to ban mobile phone sales to under 16s, one to make it easier for parents to use parental controls on devices, and one to raise the minimum age for social media sites from 13 to 16. Michelle Donlan, Technology Secretary, said children as young as 5 should not be accessing social media. The Ofcom figures come amid what The Guardian says is growing evidence of the impact of social media use amongst children, and the US government refers to it as a profound risk to mental health. The book The Anxious Generation, published in March by a US academic, has been cited as influencing thinking in number 10. The Ofcom survey was based on 2,480 parents of children aged between 3 and 17. The TES reports that absence rates are up again according to latest DfE figures. This is compared with spring 2022-23. This is despite the government's ongoing attendance drive. Overall absence for last term was 7.3%, slightly up on the 7% in the previous year. The Department for Education said the rise was likely to have been caused by a higher level of illness absence. The proportion of persistently absent pupils has also slightly increased to 21.9% of pupils who were missing 10% or more half days. The figures for disadvantaged pupils are worse when compared to their peers. Full details of the latest data can be found on TES.com. Finally, the TES also features a report that the Department for Education does not intend to replace current progress measures, known as Progress 8, for the next 2 years. After exploring alternatives, there will be no progress measures published for schools in England in 2024-25 or 2025-26. The cancellation of Year 6 SATs during the pandemic meant that there was no Key Stage 2 attainment data available as a baseline for Progress 8 calculations. Headline attainment measures will still be published and grading will take place as normal. The Department for Education says it intends to return to Progress 8 in 2026-27. Teaching unions welcomed the announcement, but some described it as a missed opportunity to rethink performance tables overall. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Welcome back. This is our first episode in our series with educators from international schools. And with us on the show, we have Gemma Donovan, head of EAL at a British Curriculum International School in Dubai. So far, we've talked about the terminology, the difference between EAL and EFL. Gemma shared with us some information about the context that she teaches in, where a large percentage of students are newcomers to the country with little to no English. And now, Gemma, tell us about more about the students. So when they come in, when the families come, how long, if you can, you know, if you can give an average, how long do they normally stay in the country and therefore then stay in the school?
Well, I mean, it depends. It really does. We've got some students who are long-standing within the school. So our school's only been open 6 years. Remember, there are lots of relatively new schools popping up around Dubai. Our school is 6 years or in its sixth year of operation. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they mostly do stay. We have students who've been there 2 or 3 years now, and to see their progress and how they've fully integrated is fantastic. And even those who only stay one academic year, it is quite wonderful to see when they do arrive in the August, quite wide-eyed and apprehensive, let's say, that by term two, they're making friends, as children are very adaptable. If I think of our primary student, primary age students in particular, you know, where our biggest number of ELL students are, they do integrate very well. And I think the positive feedback that we get as staff and as a school body and reflects in the tenor of the students and the families within the school community. They tend to stay. It's a happy school, so they do tend to stay. Obviously, it depends on individual circumstances. But yes, generally speaking, they complete quite a full journey with us.
Oh, that's really nice to hear as well. And then the positive feedback, it's what you were mentioning earlier about the social emotional side of things, right? And what you're sharing is that the school, the staff, that's also an area of concern, an area that you work on with the children. It's not just about academics and grades and just, you know, bumps on seats.
I think as a school as a whole, I mean, I'm speaking very personally within my school setting at the moment, but just from my own education background, background as a practitioner, you know that students will thrive if they are happy. It is really is as simple as that. If they're happy, welcomed, feel safe, feel valued, and you know, never more than now am I able to see that. And the immediate, as I said earlier, different to the EFL side of things when I was back in Europe, being over here now and seeing the immediacy of that.
Progress.
The emphasis, yeah, the progress, that emphasis on social emotional well-being, on welcoming not only the student but the families into the school as well. I mean, we do like most of the schools here within the Emirate, that we celebrate International Day. Students from different countries. Obviously, we are an international setting, so everybody's nationality is celebrated, and something that we do as a department as well, which we encourage the mainstream and classroom teachers to do, is to include through representation. So we have a large body of Russian students at the moment. We have signage within the classrooms of dual language signs, both in Arabic, Russian, or whatever language is most applicable to that classroom setting, so that those students feel welcome, they feel represented. And I think that's very important in them settling in and them feeling a sense of belonging, and ultimately then in their language acquisition and the, you know, academic successes.
Right. It's something that you said to me last week, wasn't it, about them, you know, seeing that their home language, that their ethnic language is accepted rather than being told from the get-go, oh, this is an international school and you can only speak English.
Obviously, the aim is to, they're being taught through the medium of English, but I'm, again, through PD and just open conversations with staff members and other staff bringing their own experiences to the table as well. Valuing ethnic languages, home languages, is a bonus and should be encouraged because students can make those connections between their L1 and the L2 or whatever, L3 in some cases. You know, these students are, some are coming with a very full language repertoire. And if they can make those connections and trans language within the classroom, all the better. It's not always the case that the teacher can speak another language. It's not necessary. Pairing them up with other students within the class who speak their language, encouraging them to make those linguistic connections is all part and parcel of them feeling welcomed and, as I say, ultimately performing better, I think.
I mean, the discourse, isn't it? It's a discourse of tolerance. It's, you know, of tolerance, of acceptance of differences rather than, you know, that top down, this is the rule here and this is how we do it. Moving on, I'm sure we've got listeners who are very curious about how, you know, how things happen on the ground. So what happens? Let's say you've got, you know, the new school year coming up. At what point do families get in touch with the school? At what point do you, as head of EAL, know what students you've got and so on? And how do placements, if at all, needs analysis? How do things like that happen?
Okay, well, as you can imagine, it's very transitory here. So throughout the academic year, students are, we're just starting term three now, apart from the slight interruption we had off site last week due to the storm. We're a couple of weeks into term three. We've had new students starting at this stage within the academic year. So that's an ongoing process. Obviously, the majority would be encouraged to start at the beginning of the school year, if that is the case. And we're told through admissions, I work closely with admissions, the students are given comprehensive tests, CAT4 and other tests upon admissions. And from our department, speaking on behalf of our department, we give them admissions, a small English test for the students to complete. It's online. And based on that, that information's trickled through to us as a department. We're able to gauge more or less the level and the level of support then we'll need to offer. We have a three-tier program, so if the students, upon meeting them, then also we realize that they need full support. They're usually taken out four times a week and given full support from our EAL team. So that would be at the beginning of their journey. If they're coming out at a very low-level English, let's say beginner level, Their English language journey would begin with survival language. So we're not really looking at curriculum language at this point. So that would be for 6 to 8 weeks, depending on the student. And then we would reassess them again. And then we'd have more knowledge then of that student's ability and strengths, areas of interest, and then really think about tailoring that support then for the individual needs of that student. Obviously, again, the ultimate aim is for them to be fully integrated within the classroom, fully accessing the curriculum, and aiming high like everybody else in the classroom.
I find it hard to believe. I find it very hard to believe that you could have someone come in into an education system with zero English and then just boom, wham, bam, you know, they're moving from survival English to reading, writing, learning about bees and photosynthesis in English. How does that happen?
Well, I think we try and adopt a CLIL approach, content language integrated learning. So encouraging the teachers to have realistic yet still high expectations of the students within the classroom environment, and scaffolding. So providing visual support, providing sentence frames, providing gap fills, encouraging the student to research in their own language at home, again, using their full linguistic repertoire. If the student comes to the class, let's think in secondary now, let's say they're tackling the topic of photosynthesis. If that student is not cognitively challenged, so they will have some understanding of what that process is in their own language. They can research in within their own language and come to class with some knowledge of the topic. I mean, I use that as an example, but any topic. And then translation tools in the early stages and make, as I say, making full use of their language tool set. To be able to understand the material until they're in a position with our support in the background. You know, they get it coming to us four times a week. That support's then gradually being whittled down to three times, then perhaps twice, where they're fully integrated in the English curriculum. And the support that we offer then is support based on the content. It's not a separate entity. It's no longer the survival English and the English language in general. And then I think it is very surprising because they're fully immersed throughout the day. You know, even if they're coming to us four times a week, for the rest of the that's only four times in a week. It's, you know, it's not even every single day. So the rest of the time, they really are fully immersed within the language, integrating with their peers, and that collaboration between an EAL department and the classroom teachers at this point, I would say, is key.
And I mean, it's not like they come in with zero knowledge. I mean, they come in with their own strategies, right? They have study strategies that they bring with them. They probably have a lot of family support as well. And they're tech savvy, right? Kids nowadays, they're tech savvy, like you said. So they'll know, you know, where to find translation tools and you know, where to watch. Yeah,
it's incredible to watch. When I've done learning walks in the past, it really is astounding how many things the students I will speak on behalf of the ELL students, how many tools and things they're having to contend with within a classroom. Again, I'm thinking specifically of the secondary students. You know, in a history class, for example, they're contending with the content, the language, the complex grammar structures, the specific vocabulary, and they can navigate their way around the devices and all of the translation tools and everything that's available to them. It really is fascinating to watch them as well use all of the tools in their arsenal to access the materials. So yes, you're right, of course, would never imply that they're coming with nothing. Of course, they're coming with their own cultural background and academic background, and that's to be obviously recognized fully.
Yeah, I think we forget that sometimes. So I think we forget that just because we're focused on language, we forget that, you know, they'd learn other languages elsewhere and they'd been to school elsewhere. You talked about them being totally immersed in the school system, in the language, outside of their four EAL hours. In addition to the support that they get from their teachers, I think part of that immersion is also them working with their classmates who probably, you know, have their own, how would you say, struggles, or who are also learners, who are also navigating the different system with them. So
absolutely. And I think what you find as well within this international context is that within a classroom of, let's say, 20 students, you will also have three or four who've been on the same journey as that student who's just arrived at the start of their journey. So there's a lot of empathy as well amongst students. And I think that peer support is to be encouraged within the classroom, the group work, the communicative tasks, collaborative tasks, all of those things where the students can really learn from one another. As you say, not only language, but also through experiences, shared experiences.
Yeah. Do you know if there are, well, you probably would, but are there any English first language pupils, students in the school?
Of course, yes, please.
And how do they, you know, interact, work together with the EALs?
There's a fantastic community within our school, and the majority of students are, and I mean this sincerely, the majority are very, very competent English speakers. We do have support network with a buddy system. So mm-hmm. we have students who are coming in the early stages, or even if they're, you know, a year in, but they're still struggling somewhat with academic language, they are encouraged to buddy up. We've recently introduced on the secondary side a scheme whereby our students, we have student leaders who are trained as, let's say, interpreters, not in the true sense of the word, but as a language buddy. The role goes beyond only language. It's really a support network for those students when they arrive. So they know who to go to within their year group or within the school, who can, you know, maybe tell them how to get to somewhere, or give them, you know, remind them of what that the homework was that day, or just a support network, because I think they do need that at the start of their journey and throughout. And I find that those who, there is little to no difference. It's one community within an international setting. I think amongst all of the schools, it really is nice to see so many different nationalities and, you know, working together.
That's brilliant, I think, that buddy system, that mentor system. We have it here in my children's schools as well. And I think it's different for children, you know, it's different for kids to be able to go to a peer, an older student that they know, or that they know, okay, that person is my go-to person. It's very different for them going to that person as compared to going to a teacher, because if they were to go to a teacher, some kids might think that, you know, they're being bothersome, and they might feel ashamed or embarrassed about that. And friendships develop, right? Friendships develop out of this, and they in turn might become buddies in the future.
Exactly. And it's a win-win for all parties, really. You're developing student leaders within the school body. You're providing mentorship, as you said, peer support, which is always to be encouraged. And it ultimately has a real positive effect on student well-being. If students are happy to come to school each day because they know that they've got friends or trusted peers who they can confide in or ask for help, it makes a massive difference, I think.
Yeah, we should have something like that in, you know, in our traditional EMI or, you know, regular schools. It's a shame we don't have that. We're going to take another break to listen to a message from our sponsors. And when we come back, Gemma, I'd like to focus on the teacher side of things. And you could then share with us, you know, how, what your teachers do, how they've been supported, how they've been trained, and how, you know, subject teachers and EAL teachers work together. But first, here's the message from our sponsors.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more, and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
Okay, so talk about teachers. From what you've described, Gemma, EAL for me now is, you know, definitely not the same as teaching EFL. It's not the same, you know, as going into a language class in a language school, knowing, right, these are my students, they've got 15 weeks, they're at A1 part one, and we want to get them up to A1 part two at the end of this 15-week course. It's very different. And as such, I believe teachers need to be aware of the student needs, the student's goals, and student backgrounds. What else do teachers working with EAL students need to know?
Well, one of the key trainings we did at the beginning of our academic year at the school I'm currently in was with regards to how students learn language, that they're making teachers who perhaps don't speak another language or have not been exposed to language learning to a great extent, that there will be a silent period. There will be a period in which the students aren't producing any language. That as a teacher, you're not to be afraid of that. Students are progressing, and they will surprise you. I think patience is key with our EAL learners, our EAL pupils, I should say, because all of a sudden, what we found, which has been great this year to watch and witness, is that come term two, those students who perhaps were producing nothing in term one, and you thought, oh, goodness, you know, there may have been some feedback of, oh, I'm not quite sure whether they're fully comprehending, you know, the tasks, etc. Once they've felt confident after the holidays, they've come back and started really producing. And then before you know it, they're really trying hard and conversing, and to see them interacting with their friends around the school during the school day is incredibly rewarding. So yes, making teachers aware, or reminding them, I suppose, as well, in many cases, just of how we learn language. If we think all back, we've all learned language, I suppose. From children, there is a period in which we're observing and taking everything in. And that's the same with any language learner at whatever stage. So really making them aware of that. And again, I won't tire of saying, with regards to the social emotional side of things, if the student feels welcomed within the class, even if they're not interacting straight away, or if a smile and a welcoming arm each morning into class, sitting them near you at the front of the classroom, involving them as best you can, really gives them a sense of belonging. And that also helps with their language journey at all levels, from young ages right through to secondary school. And keeping an eye on them, you know, asking them how they are. And if we have, which we're lucky to have within the international setting we're in, we do have Arabic-speaking staff, and we have Russian-speaking staff, and so on and so forth. So making the most of the languages we have within our own environment as well, and using those staff members in the best possible way to talk with the students in their own language, to again be somebody of support to them as well within their own language. So yes, I think just really highlighting that, yes, we're an international school, yes, the medium of instruction is English, however, there are many languages within the school body. They should all be celebrated, recognized, and that language learning, these students who are learning language are very gifted. They are coming, you know, at a young age, perhaps with two languages already, they will learn and they will excel.
And they're more resilient, right? They're more resilient than we think, because we have, you know, I have examples of adults who go to a foreign language and who to a foreign country and who stay there for months and insist that the local people that they deal with should speak English to them rather than the other way around, rather than them, you know, the guest, so to speak, making the effort to learn the language of the host country.
No, I agree. I mean, here in the UAE, I have to say my knowledge of Arabic is quite limited. I am a keen linguist. It's a very difficult language to learn. But again, it does go a long way just being able to greet within the language of the host country and show that effort. Obviously, with the past in Italy where I lived, I am fully fluent in Italian, and it does make a big difference. But even if you're not at that stage, just showing willing, as you say, to your host country, and even though we're within an international setting, I think it's not to be forgotten that it's not the predominant language, you know?
Yeah. What other things do you cover in terms of professional development for your teachers? So I've got, you know, the social emotional learning that you've done with them, or, you know, made them aware of. You mm-hmm. talked about second language acquisition, understanding how children learn languages or how languages are learned. What other things do you cover if you were to do professional development with your staff?
I think we touched on it earlier, but the strategies of scaffolding, good, sound scaffolding, differentiating, adapting tasks. So again, pre-teaching vocabulary. I know it can be quite contentious. Should we or should we not? However, offering visual support to students, offering dual language support where necessary, and breaking tasks down. Because as I say, I think within this context, because there are a lot of students within the school settings in general who arrive early on in their English language journey, who have to access the curriculum, as we spoke about earlier, teachers have to be made aware of those strategies that are out there that perhaps are already being used in differentiated tasks. It's perhaps just taking it that one step further and really looking at the language, really looking at what language do the students need in order to be able to complete the task. And I think sometimes that can be overlooked. We might look at the vocabulary, but if we're looking at a task that deals with the past, what type of language, grammar structures will the students need? And perhaps a reminder to everybody within an EAL setting, as I say, international settings often are EAL predominantly EAL settings, that reminder of grammar structures and how we form present perfect, past simple for argument's sake, or past irregulars is a good reminder to most of the students within that classroom environment. I have two children myself, both of whom were born in Italy. One, my daughter is 11. She's fully competent in English. However, we speak Italian and English at home, so she's exposed to another language. And there are still errors within her grammatical structures. So I know that even though on the surface she's a fluent English speaker, that focus on language and on grammar structures is beneficial to all in these cases.
Yeah. I mean, we do that as well at university, even though we know, you know, our students know the particular grammar structures. But when we're teaching, for example, if we're for university students, if I'm getting them to write an introduction to their term paper, then we look at, you know, when do we use the present perfect there, and when do we use the past simple, right? I can tell from the way you're describing it, I can tell why, you know, having gone into EAL, your passion for language teacher has been reignited after so many years of EFL. Tell us briefly, how do EAL teachers work together with subject teachers?
Well, we have... I have, for example, I have an open door policy, and I also have office hours during the week where teachers can come in with any curriculum that they are due to present or are presenting, and are able to, you know, we work together. How could that topic be presented in the best possible way? Similarly, on the secondary side, partaking in curriculum meetings, team meetings. So the science department perhaps would meet weekly. We'll go every other week to their department meetings, or within some departments, perhaps just stay for the first 5 minutes, check in on our students' needs, if right. see if anybody needs to raise anything, and then take it from there. So it really does have to be a team effort, because as I say, taking the students out for those sessions during the week can't be the only support that's given. We really need to, we push into class as well where necessary and try and support in that way. It's really where the needs are, and making ourselves known, visible and available to all staff. And I think that's mm-hmm. key for a successful department.
Last question for you. Do your EAL or do you, I can't articulate it. Do EAL teachers in your school, do they have a second, either a second teaching subject, or do they come with a degree in a different subject, for example, science? Do they have to know? Basically, put this way, are they just pure language teachers, or is it essential for them to know something about science or about geography or history?
No. For in our context in particular, we have EAL specialists who are EFL background teachers, masters, qualified. And then we have our language, our learning support assistants, who are our ELL learning support assistants, who perhaps have already a language background themselves. In our particular case, we have a learning support assistant who's just recently done CELTA. So there's also that continual professional development amongst our department itself. It's not necessary that the language teacher has the subject specific knowledge. It's too vast to, we're right. supporting across all subjects. So I'm sure it would be helpful. Some teachers may have that. They may have been within the classroom and have moved into EAL. But no, within my particular context at the moment, we are EAL specialists, second language learners, specialists in language acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a message to share with our listeners, either about EAL or about supporting learners or supporting, you know, multilingual learners?
Teaching journey.
One message.
It's a message from Claire Jenkins.
Oh, Claire, yes.
And she says, she says, Roy is...
What's Hello? Just happened there?
Yeah. Sorry.
Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened then. My apologies.
That's okay.
Do I have a message
from Claire Jenkins? But what's your message?
My apologies. No, my message is, I suppose the key takeaway for me is that we are all language teachers. It may seem cliched, but I think certainly within our international settings or in schools where there is a large EAL population, we, regardless of subject specialisation, we are all fundamentally literacy teachers, improving literacy skills, and all teachers are language teachers would be my key takeaway.
Thank you so much, Gemma. That's all we have time for today. Thank you for your insights. Gemma, you sound really, really passionate. I can hear it in your voice. I'm sure we can all hear it in your voice. And the way you describe it, like I said, I can understand how, you know, moving into EAL has kind of helped you find your mojo again. Your expertise, your insights are valuable. We appreciate the time you've taken to be with us today. Thank you, Gemma.
Thank you so much, Kanduk, for the invitation. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, listeners, for joining us on Teachers Talk Radio. Remember, you can listen back to episodes on ttradio.org. Have a good week.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.